This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tung Phat.
My name is Andrew Lam. I was born in Vietnam. I left at the end of the war at age 11. Became a writer after I graduated from Berkeley as a biochemist, and then went to San Francisco State to get a master in creative writing, just because next thing you know, I became a journalist. And I cover Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, Indonesia, and really Hong Kong, and wrote three books. And I have a next book coming out called Stories from the Edge of the Sea.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
Thank you so much for coming on, Andrew. We had corresponded when I first started the podcast 4 years ago, and I think it was during COVID. You were locked up and you were in country, and so we were just trying to figure it out, and I dropped the ball. So I apologize for that, but here we are today. So thank you so much for coming on.
Sure. I'm back in San Francisco, but it was really a strange moment in my life because my father passed while I was stuck in Vietnam. And it was one of those moments where I continue to have regrets because I always thought I would see him again, because since 2018, I started moving back to Vietnam, at least temporary, since I stopped being a journalist. And I just went back and forth, and I did not see COVID coming. And so when the country shut down, it became a watershed moment for me as well, I'm sure for everyone, because the world seems to completely shifted from that time. And so I never got to see my father again. And, it's one of my biggest regret. And, things have a lot changed since then, but I've finished another book. So at least there's something that came out of it.
I do want to begin with your father, and I think I share a lot of the sort of experience of having a father in the South Vietnamese government's military, but your father was a general, and my father was a captain, and I don't think that my father lived out the uniform as much as your father did. Your father lived and breathed it. And so I wanted to ask you... your father was a big figure in the country at the time, but I want to know how that has affected you in terms of his perhaps overshadowing any future sort of endeavors that you wanted or dreams and hopes that you wanted to do in your life. Did you ever sort of relate back to his successes and think that you had to be better than him?
Yeah, I mean, if you read my first book, Perfume Dreams, so much of my father loomed large in it. And even in my second book called East Eats West, there's an episode where I talk about, going to Waterloo with my dad and looking over the landscape of losses, because that's where Napoleon was defeated. My father was, to say the least, larger than life. I mean, he... very accomplished man. And when I was a child, he didn't seem like a man. He seemed like a god, He flew in helicopter to come home, he picked me up at school with a helicopter on the way to out of parachute when I was like six or seven. He taught people how to shoot guns, and he designed military tactics that won him a lot of battles, spoke fluent French, a scholar. I think it had more of an effect on my older brother, who was his older, you know, the oldest son, because my father kind of raised him more. You know, I was mama's boy. I'm the youngest in the family. So in a way, I managed to escape that shadow because there's a lot of feminine energy within me, you know, because I was raised by my mother. My father was hardly ever around. But there are pictures of my brother, who's 5 years older, who carry the map of the battle with him in the while standing next to my father, because I think in some way my brother certainly saw himself walking in my dad's footsteps, you know. Dad became a three-star general in when he was 32.
Wow.
You know, because of his military wins, and he had no political affiliations. He just came up in the rank, you know, year after year. And they kept sending him to the front near the end. But
my God, that is insanity. 32 years old, and he became a three-star general?
The youngest.
That is. I don't know how to explain that, to put that into context for the bigger world. You know, there's plenty of times when you're even at 35, you don't even become a colonel, a full-bird colonel.
Right. He went to this military school called Vabi. You probably know.
Vabi Dalak.
Mm-hmm. And then he was the administrator there, you know. He came up in ranks in a way that astonished people, you know. I mean, he studied French philosophy, you know, French educated, and then next thing you know, he became this warrior. But what's so interesting about my father's side of family, because they came from a rich family from Baklio area, which is deep in the Mekong Delta, and his older brother became a general too, two-star. So within the same family, there's two generals, right? And his younger brother became a lieutenant colonel, you know, as well. And so it's a whole family of people. I think back to your question, I think I managed to get out of that shadow because we came to America.
Yeah, you escaped it.
I escaped it because the war ended, and then that sheen of invincibility faded. My father remade himself in America, and he is one of those few people of his generation who became very successful in America. He went on to get a master's in MBA, and then he became, at the end of his career, assistant vice president of Bank of America. This is, mind you, someone who fought in the war for 25 years. So when he reached America, he was 43, I think, you know, and within 7 years, he was an executive in the Bank of America. And when he passed, he wrote 3 books in English. And so, you know, it's not something that, you know, most Vietnamese of his generation can claim. And you know, but I'm always grateful for that, because in a way, I grew up in an atypical Vietnamese refugee family, because by the time I was in high school, we were already in middle class, because, you know, after 3 years in America, my dad with his salary bought us a house, you know. So while other kids were still struggling because of, you know, broken family, you know, refugee experience by both people, as you know, we were already, you know, going to Europe for vacation. So if there was a shadow, there was also the benefit of having such an accomplished man as a father, because I went blissfully on with my American life, you know, which is to say very ironic, because I'm the youngest in the family. I forgot how to speak Vietnamese by the time I went to high school. And yet I became a writer who explored Vietnamese history as an adult, and now probably as an old man. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Yes, you know? Yes. Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
There's this other side that we as children of this first generation, these heroes in a certain context, heroes within sort of their ranks and their world. Yeah. But have you had a chance to kind of sidestep the heroism?
I am lucky in many sense because I watched how my brother suffer for trying to mimic or emulate my father. You know?
Yeah.
Because you can never that space. You know, that space is created by sheer individual strength, not by just following the same routine. You know, my brother was 11 when he had his black belt in Taekwondo because my father had a third belt in Taekwondo. You know what I mean? You know, there is a hero worshiping aspect to my brother that sort of didn't really fall onto me. I early on discovered the love of books and I immersed in literature, you know, and I saw other ways of being, and in some way that imagination let me out of the shadow.
Yeah.
I didn't want to become my father, you know. There's a passage, I think, in the first book where my father say to me when I was 33 that at your age, I was a 3-star general. And I say, yeah, but I'm not in the military and I'm not fighting your war, you know? So
how did he react to that? How did he react to that reply?
He always knew that I'm rebellious, not in a very like confrontational way, but he knew I was sort of thinking for myself, even when your path out for myself, because I always think differently from the family, you know. I remember in East West, I talk about how after college, you know, everyone thought I was going to go to medical school and I didn't, you know, I got into creative writing, and my father, you know, basically sat me down and he say, you know, name for me, you know, this is 1989, you know, 14 years after the diaspora started. And he said, how are you going to do it? Because can you name for me a Vietnamese in America who's making a living writing in English, you know? And I was thinking, I have no idea who is out there, because back then, you know, you have no way of finding out, like on the internet, who's writing. No one big enough so that you can read in the newspaper. In practice, there was none really. And so then I thought about it like, well, Dad, there's always going to be a first one, and I'm going to be one, you know, I'm going to be the first. And I remember sort of a look on his face, it's sort of like, wow, what a cheeky boy, you know. And, you know, being practical, and my family being practical. So, well, if you try and you fail, then promise us you at least go to dental school. And I was thinking, dental school, oh my God, you know. So I thought, I better make it or I'm gonna have to be a dentist, you know.
Do you ever look back and because, you know, the writing route is very difficult and it is strenuous and sometimes very stressful about money, did you ever stop in those years going, I really wish I followed my mom and dad's plans?
Well, I'd be lying if I tell you that I didn't. I was working while I was at Berkeley in a cancer research lab, you know, so I was a lab assistant, and, you know, for a couple years there, actually three, I worked in a, you know, in sort of all sort of research and, you know, picked up a lot of skills, you know. And so I have big folders of how to make collagen, how to, you know, create certain type of acid, you know, the skill set that is useful for assistant in a laboratory. And I kept those folders with me even as I was in a creative writing program, because I thought, I still have a skill set if I fail. But I never told my parents that, you know. So there were moments where you have a lot of self-doubt, you know, because I actually, English is actually my third language. I spoke Vietnamese and spoke in school. So basically, I had something to fall back to, even though I knew I didn't want to go back to the cancer research to kill, you know, laboratory mice, and, you know, working there. But, you know, I really wanted to figure out if I can make it, even though there was a lot of things against me, simply because, you know, we were a refugee family. English is not our first language, any of ours. You know, most people during that time were trying to find jobs so they can buy a house. You know, and here is someone who has this fanciful idea, you know, 15 years into the diaspora, to wanting to be an American writer.
Were you one of the first guys to get published? Because I know
pretty much. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, yeah. I got published in LA Times in 1989. So, you know, that's really, I have clippings. Back then we don't have internet, so we have a newspaper service where you have clippings coming back.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't remember of any older, you know, writers in the United States. I think you're one of the, if not one of the first people to get published and really put a name out there for yourself. I mean, there's the other Andrew who wrote Catfish and Mandela.
Fum? Yeah. Andrew Fum. He came up later on. Yeah.
After you. Yes.
Yeah. There was a person who works in radio back then, is Nguyen Quy Duc, you know, who passed away.
Yes, we just passed.
Good friend of mine. But he was not a writer so much as a radio
personality.
Yeah. And then there was a person who wrote for the San Jose Mercury News, named TT New, NHU. But that was all I knew when I got into the fray of, you know, writing. And
what about Mai Elliott?
She was a translator, and she published a book at some point. The first novel was by Lan Gao,
who's
Da Vang Vinh.
Yes, yes.
And so that was the first novel in English, I think.
So Lan Gao published before you did?
I can't remember. I published in newspaper before she did, but I think she published a novel.
Yeah.
She was the first to publish a novel. She's a very good friend. She wrote a wonderful blurb for my next book coming out. In any case, you know, I was talking about before the Wi-Fi went haywire, how English is my third language, you know, and it's a very bizarre thing to feel any confident in, you know, speaking the language, left alone writing and being among American intellectuals, you know. And when I joined a news service here in San Francisco, Composite News Service, which is part of AP Wire, you know, there were people who were so long experience in publishing, had books out, and here's this refugee kid sitting there in the editorial room suggesting ideas that he's nowhere confident that it has any, you know, gravitas at all, you know. And so it was a lot of lack of self-confidence at the beginning, you know. That's why those folders were sitting there on my shelf.
Yeah.
Because I thought, my God, who am I to think that I can write? You know, my dad might be right. There's a lot of self-doubt. You know, for any artist who go into the world of art and writing, there's self-doubt already. But for a Vietnamese refugee in America, who speak English as his third language, and to be honest, my father used to do my English language homework when I was in high school.
What was your second language?
French. I went to French school. Well, half Vietnamese, half French school. You know, And so I didn't speak English when I came here.
How old were you when you came?
11. I was turning almost 12.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's very late to be learning English.
Yeah. It was a very strange time because, you know, I'm writing a piece right now for a magazine about how it's very odd for a certain type of refugees of my age group because you not only lose a country, but you lose your childhood at the same time. Because I was migrating not just out of Vietnam, but out of a world of wonders. You know, and so English, you know, became part of me just when my voice broke, you know. So it was a very magical language because my, you know, we didn't know about the birds and the bees and nothing. And so my older brother, you know, in my family, my dad did not like us speaking English, you know, at dinner time or anything, because, you know, he wanted us to keep the language alive, yeah. You know, Vietnamese language. Although he spoke French fluently, so then he always like inserted French into Vietnamese, although I don't think he think French is a foreign language to him anyway.
That makes a lot of sense. I get it.
It's very weird. Yeah. He would like, you know, when he's drunk, he would recite a French poem, right? But he'd say, don't speak English.
English.
And so, but I couldn't help it because that's how I moved out from the realm of his control. And my brother would say, you know why you have this voice now that sounds like a duck? You know? It's because dad told you not to speak English in the house, and you speak so much of it that you shattered your vocal cord. And then I believed him because no one told me about the birds and the bees. So I thought, oh my God, you know, I spoke French as a kid and it didn't do a damn thing, you know? And here I am speaking English, and it changed me physiologically inside out. You know, I'm growing hair and my voice broke. So then I thought, my God, this language is amazing. You know, it's like magical incantation, you know? And so I kind of went with it because, like, what else do I have?
You know? Yeah, yeah. Now, are you still close with your brother?
Yeah, well, we have, oh my God, this is going to be public. We have a gap between us. It's funny because my brother, you know, was sent to English language program in Vietnam. So he actually got to the United States a few years before the war ended and went to high school here, which is a rare thing.
Rare.
Mm-hmm. And so he, in a way, technically should be so integrated in American culture.
Yeah.
And in some way he is, but in some way he's very Vietnamese, you know, and conservative and holding on to certain belief system that my parents' generation, where I'm sort of considered very liberal. So we're different politically, you know, and also our worldview is very different. You know, I think my brother is so much more bound by the history of Vietnam, the memory of Vietnam, whereas I am trying to make sense of it, but I'm not bound by it.
Right.
The same way as like my father is a very nuanced thing. It's the same way as my father, who was obsessed with Vietnam when he was alive, you know, but who never got to see that country again. You know, he talked about it every day. He remembers the battles. He remembers the friends he left behind, the regrets. You know, he wrote these books. You know, the Battle of An Lộc was basically to honor the men who fought the war to the end, you know. And yet he never saw Vietnam again because he was in exile, because he would never tolerate that country under communism, you know. Whereas I saw Vietnam not as my destiny, you know. It was just a place where I go and visit and write about and leave. You know, which I still in a way do, you know, and so yet we're both are connected to Vietnam, but not in that same way, you know, whereas my brother and my father in some way, you know, my sister too, you know, there is a sense of loss and that is irretrievable for them, you know, and for me, I process that loss into language, into stories, you know, which is why I write, you know, and then make sense out of it. So I'm no longer bound by the loss, you know. So there is that gap, which is very hard to explain.
but because there's that gap, we are in essence a very different tribe, you and me. As it relates to your brother's generation, it's a very different tribe. We're a little bit more progressive, right. A lot more progressive, liberal. And we're dealing with an older generation who is much more conservative, has the values of that first generation. So in essence, they are part of that first generation. But does that limit how close you and your brother and sister can become?
Yeah, I think it does create a gap the same way as it created a gap between me and my father on our worldview, you know? The one thing that I would say that is kind of ironic was that I was the only one who really had serious conversation with my dad, because we're both intellectuals and we both have a way of trying to make sense of the world, you know? My brother was not. My brother is not this literary person, you know, he's an engineer. But conversation that my mom would say, why that's our guy, you know, why are you arguing with your father? But I thought my father was the one who taught me that the principle of democracy was really not just to vote, but the ability and the right to disagree, you know, and he taught me this very early on, you know, and so I apply that principle with my father, which is that my dad has a very conservative point of view. And I said, well, I disagree. I don't think I could say I disagree in Vietnamese, you know, con không đồng ý, you know, but I can say, I disagree, Dad, you know, you know what I mean? And it allows us this sort of weird space where we actually have real conversation about how we see the world, you know? And I think in some way I get along with my father more because, you know, at least he would engage with me in kind of a political field, you know? Anyway, that gap remains to be filled, really, because I think there's so much to sort of figure out, like why we have this different kind of affiliation.
Yeah, you know? I that's why I bring it up, because I know that there are, you know, the transitional camp like us, you and I, we kind of have one foot in the old first generation and one foot out in the new generation. Right. But we're not fully either one of these camps. You know,
I feel like it's true. But, you know, I think how do I put this? I think for some people, they are bound by that history and they have no way to get out of that binding.
You're absolutely right.
And for me, even if I step back in, it's from my own personal will and interest, not because I'm bound by it. You know, I can choose not to, right? And I can choose not to let it own me because I have processed it through writing and so on. Right? And so even if we both look at Vietnam, my brother and I, we don't have the same lens, because I look at it kind of like from a kind of point of view of interest and curiosity. Whereas my brother, I would venture, would look at it from the point of view of loss and defeat and unforgivable acts of, you know, what he perceived as aggression from the North, you know. So there is a way in which we don't see eye to eye, even though we had suffered from the same losses. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We lost the same house, the same country.
Yeah, and this is what I grapple with daily in my brain, because, you know, my history and that history is not the same. I was born in the United States, so neither do I feel like the history of Vietnam in Vietnam and the Vietnamese in Vietnam is my history. It's
It's so complicated, because if you go to Vietnam, there's so many different stories from different angle to that history, you know? And so I now have run into not second, but third generation Vietnamese Americans making a living in Vietnam. And for them, Vietnam is not the past. It's not anything but opportunities, because it's been so far removed, you know, the
yes, that third generation are young enough to be our children. They're old enough to be our children. And
they are now in their early 20s, and they're like, the first job, or you know, and they're excited because you know what, they see Vietnam as the Wild Wild West. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They know that their grandparents came from there. They know that there is this history, but it's almost like telling your kid, like, aren't you mad about Watergate? And they're like, water who? You know what I mean?
So true.
And they're like, but no, I want to bring Chipotle to Vietnam. You know what I mean? So the nuance is really amazing to me, you know? So that the idea that you expect one generation to follow the passion of the to take on the mantle of the, you know, of the previous, you're gonna be sorely disappointed. You know, my father would say, "Don't speak Vietnamese English in the house," but you know, he spoke English with his grandchildren because none of them speak Vietnamese, and he loved them dearly. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
You start to lose grip on what's the Americanization do to you.
Yeah.
And this is why every generation have to learn new history anew.
Yeah, yeah. Andrew, I want to take this conversation in a very random direction right now, okay? I was very good friends with a woman named Phuong An. And I know that, yeah, look at you. You're like lighting up. I want to talk about Phuong An, and I want to kind of like talk about her on this podcast because she has a very cool story that you and I share, and a lot of people in LA share too. She, I met her because she owned a really cool restaurant bar called Dominic's in here in LA, in Beverly, right by Beverly Hills.
I've been there.
Yes, and I would go there with a lot of our Vietnamese friends in the early days. It was like in the early 2000s, she had this restaurant called Dominic's, and it was a mainstream white sort of like, it was a hip, big place. Mm-hmm. It had a backyard, a back patio area. It had a front patio, old Hollywood feel to Dominic's. And so that's how I met Phuong An. And then she moved to Vietnam and started Q-Bar shortly after Dominic's. And so she's had a string of these historic sort of places in the center of LA and Saigon. And I want to talk about her because we share that history, and I wanted to talk about her. So one day I'm going to ask her to come on the podcast to talk about the early days in Vietnam. You guys all.
I just saw her last month before I came back to San Francisco.
I would love to hear that. So how did you meet Phuong An, and tell me who Phuong An is?
Yeah, okay, so I'm going to make a little correction about that history. She actually had the Q Bar in Vietnam before she started Dominic's. She was the first Vietnamese American to come back to open a bar in Vietnam. And this is 1993.
Wow. And you know, this is no regular bar. The Q Bar is a bar right underneath the Opera House.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's some random, like, you know, restaurant.
Yeah, somewhere. So she's one of those amazing people that I met over the years, you know. And I wrote about her in Perfume Dreams, you know. And I also wrote essays about her. And one day I remember she called me up and sounding really angry because she read it in a newspaper. And I talk about her new, you know, all these movie stars. You know, and how she always like so chic, and you know, even though she was a boat person, and you know, her siblings died on the boat and so on. And I thought, my God, you know, maybe I went too far. And she said, "Andrew, I don't wear Versace; it's too gaudy."
That is totally her. She has this very simple and bold flair, the style that is just so deep. And
so there is this Vietnamese that you should look for. It's called, it's called from this group of photographers that were allowed like a week in Vietnam very early on, and they took photos.
Chicken
of,
shot.
Yes. And so it's the one of most famous is by oh my God, Canal, the first lap. Sorry. She took a full photo of Phuong An holding a chicken. And she was on a Vespa. And one of her in the back, probably bar, and she was wearing tight shorts and a bikini top and sunglasses. So, and that photo sort of went viral because it's like, it's so iconic of Fuhan, but it's also really daring because you have to think this is like mid 90s, you know?
So let me explain this picture to everybody. This picture is iconic. She is on the back of a motorbike and she pulls over, maybe it's a stall or something, and she buys a chicken or something. She's holding the chicken by the neck.
A live chicken.
And I was at my friend's house, his chic apartment, you know, a film director. And this was just a few years ago. We were just at the, and he had this poster of Fung An in the thing. I was like, oh my God, that's a picture of my friend. And that picture is very iconic because it shows the transition of Vietnam coming out of the old cycle of poverty and it ushered in the new age of where Vietnam was heading.
Yeah, I mean, it was early. For that signal, but Fuhan was always like ahead of the trend, you know? And so, you know, and I have to say that, so the name is Catherine Cornell. Please forgive me, Catherine. She's a good friend. We actually work together on National Geographic. But anyway, so that was iconic, you know. And it's incidentally, we were, Phuong Anh and I were in Vietnam like a couple years ago, and Catherine was back. And she had a book of photography where I actually wrote the foreword for. Anyway, Catherine, I'm so sorry. Anyway. And she was showing her photos, right? And Phuong Anh and I were sitting there, and one of the photos of Vietnam was that iconic image. And she say, and the woman who is in this photo is in the audience. and Phuong Anh was like, suddenly she's like hiding under my arm. So that's iconic. But there is a point I want to make about VQ who come back. It's because back then, you know, coming back is still very rare, right? Because of the difficulties of all the paperwork and the monitoring and the suspicion and all that. So that to come back to try to make a living is daring on so many different levels because politically it's still not safe. And economically, they would try to, you know, take your business, you know. So there's all this insurmountable challenges to do business in Vietnam. And so yet there she was, you know, making a living, digging up that ground floor of the Q Bar. And I was there when she was doing it. So, you know, I was also first Vietnamese among the first Vietnamese Americans to come back to write about Vietnam. So, yet, when those people came back, you know, the first generation who came back, they made such an impression on Vietnam itself because, you know, Phuong Anh, you know, her chic Q Bar from, you know, with the LA style and stuff, you know, became so iconic that anyone who was anyone would show up at that bar back in the 90s. And because of it, within a few years, you see this similar type of chic bars, you know, springing up all everywhere. Around.
She was the prototype of these chic bars.
Yeah. And so that was an example of how these things work. The same thing with Nguyen Quy Đức when he went to Hanoi and started this bar called Tadi Oto, you know, some years later, and then decided to make it into a kind of literary artsy salon. And it became sort of like the center for avant-garde artists who didn't have a place before, you know. And there was Duke, you know, sitting there playing the bongos and, you know, had his beard and smoked his cigar, whatever it was, giving this very beatnik vibe. And for Hanoi kids at that time, it's so appealing because it's like there's nothing like that before. You know what I mean? Like, and so the the frontiersmen of the diaspora were these people who came back and sort of bring back the knowledge, the know-how, the software. I mean, I even knew the guy who created the Vietnamese font from Silicon Valley, you know, who added all the diacritic stuff for the fonts when we start have, you know, internet and so on. So, you know, I think in many ways, a lot of us were pioneers in all this area. And so, you know, girls were starting putting on bikini tops, you know, going to bar because of Phương An, you know,
which is unheard of,
right?
In such a modest society, you know, Phương An was definitely one of the, you know, living on the edge. When you see that picture, you're like, whoa, this is,
she was reprimanded by the mayor of Saigon back then. But, you know, she, you know, such as, you know, but then now the world of Vietnam has changed and shifted so much, you know, that you have this new population of young people who have now spent a lot of time overseas. They're in American or English speaking schools in Vietnam, and they have that cosmopolitan sheen even before they left the country. Sort of like, it kind of reminds me of my father's side of the family, where everyone was French speaking, you know, during the war, and they went to school like Marie Curie, you know, and, you know, my aunts were speaking French to each other at home rather than English, and everyone's like, wow, so chic, right? And now, you know, in Vietnam, I see kids in Vietnam from Vietnamese family who prefer to speak to each other in English rather than Vietnamese.
They can't even speak Vietnamese, a lot of them.
Vietnamese well. And so you know, the Venn diagram of VQ and Vietnamese starting to have this large overlap right now, right in center. I have friends in Vietnam who study overseas who came back and do not consider themselves Vietnamese Americans, but their English is probably better than 80% of Vietnamese American because they are so immersed in American school and, you know, American language and so on. So it's very strange. It's very strange, but it does remind me of French speaking family of my father's generation.
Yeah.
You know, never saw France.
So are you ultimately going to retire in Vietnam, or do you like this sort of bi-coastal kind of move?
Well, I think I'm young enough still to be able to sit on a plane, you know, because it's like 22 hours, you know. Yeah. So I love going back and forth. You know, I love the idea that I can afford it, at least for the last few years, you know, to go back and forth, because I feel that it is such a privilege to belong to two different places at the same time, you know, to have different sets of sensibilities, to go from one border to the next, and then next thing you know, you immerse in the locality of the place, you know, and there's a different set of culture when you go there.
Yeah.
You know, like next week, I'm going to Napa because all my family are so into wine. So we're, you know, we're just going to do wine tasting. You know, when I'm in Vietnam, you know, there's this like, oh my God, you have to try this pho bar here, you know, and then this boom bar there. And so like the street food passion there, you know, so like, and coffee passion, you know, so like, so there are different sensibilities, and I love the ability to sort of take up the space when I enter a place. And it gives me this sense of being so privileged, you know, to be able to do that.
You know, as a writer and somebody who's exploring the culture, the ever-changing culture of Vietnam, are you sometimes thinking, because it's not that I have this dark view, but sometimes I feel like I'm chasing something that I feel like is changing, but there's a lot of stagnation there as well. And I call it dark because when I think of the culture not changing and not being better, it's just a really dark feeling for me. So do you have this feeling that Vietnamese culture throughout Vietnam and here in the diaspora is a stagnant in terms of the way we're looking at each other across the ocean? Is it dark to you, or do you have a lot of hope that things are changing?
Wow, that's such a loaded question.
Sorry.
I will say this. I will say that I have a lot of hope for individuals on both sides of the ocean. People like you, people like Thao Le, people, you know, in Vietnam who are sort of striking on their own to do something that their own vision give them, you know, I do not see on the collective level a lot of sophistication on either side. you know what I mean? The same way as I would say that, you know, when people say, oh, Vietnamese American is so wealthy and influential, I say, no, certain individual Vietnamese Americans are so impressive and interesting, but collectively, not really. And the same way as I would say that the culture of Vietnam is so boring to me, you know, and non-thinking in some ways, but there are always individuals who sort of rise stand above, pray, and say something that's unique that make you turn around and say, oh, you know what I mean? So I don't have a strong feeling for the collective movement of something, but I do have a soft spot for individuals who entertain me, who give me insights into things. So that's all I can say. But in terms of progress, it's sort of one step forward and two steps back. You know what I mean? And it's too bad because, I mean, just yesterday, my Facebook is inundated by the stupid effort in Hội An to clean up the oldest bridge. And the oldest bridge is like over 1,000 years old, and it has this sort of really antique-y feeling. And the way they thought was going to fix it was just paint over the whole thing. And now it looks like someone just built it for Disneyland, you know, and this is the sensibility that I would say the collective aesthetic sense, you know, you make everything new so it looks better. But the visitors were going there because it's an ancient fucking bridge. Wow. You know, you know what I mean?
Travesty.
It is a travesty. But when you ask me about the collective aesthetic, that's what I think of, which is that they don't get it. They don't get it. The same way as like where I grew up is Da Lạt, you know, and its beauty was the nature. And what do? They make it into a pseudo, you know, D-ride Disneyland, mm-hmm. where you know, all the falls, you know, with natural water coming down, suddenly now have seven dwarfs, you know, standing by the water, or, you know, Bambi looking stupidly on. And to them, aesthetically, that's somehow supposed to attract tourists, but it just look stupidly like unthinking, you know. And so if you ask me on a collective level, I don't think there is sophistication yet, you know, and that hasn't really came up. But individuals who have visions always strike me as interesting, and you know, maybe they change things like the way Phương An did, you know, all those years ago, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, I heard that's what has happened in Fukuok. It's just the Disneylandization.
You know, there are like a Venetian kind of look.
Yeah.
You know, but pseudo, because everything is just facade, and everyone's
a copy.
Yeah, but you can see that even with architecture, when people try to turn their, you know, mega mansion into looking like you know, the Disney castle, you know. And it doesn't work really well because, you know, it's not a Disney castle and everything looks kind of stilted, you know. But that's what I mean about a collective sense of aesthetic, is that it's not there yet, you know. So then I would say culturally it's not that appealing to me, a lot of these things. Same thing with literature, because people say you should read this person or read that person. And I can read in Vietnamese, but I'm not impressed because they are so hampered by self-censorship, you know. The same way Vietnamese American literature is not allowed to be published mostly in Vietnam because our work is considered, you know, phản động or anti, you know, communist propaganda, because, you know, the moment you say I was a boat person or I was a refugee who fled persecution, there is already a disagreement, because the official point of view is that all Vietnamese who left were economic refugees who were looking for better life elsewhere, right? So even the starting of that narrative already is a, you know,
it's charged,
point to pass. And so, so, you know, there's a lot more mind rubbing and exposure remains to be said on both sides, you know. And
but,
I think
let me let me ask you this, Andrew. How do we get both sides to up the game of what you're really describing as taste? You know, let's just be blunt about this, because where does taste come from? You know, like when we think about, when you told me about the Hoi An Bridge, I'm thinking the Japanese would never do something like that, right?
Right.
They would probably take a year to kind of figure out how do we create this, how do we fossilize this antique that's been around for 1,000 years? How do we make it, how do we make it, create this sort of ember in fossil record to make it just shine, but shine in a way that just, you know, works with the 1,000-year history of that bridge. Right. We don't do that. We have not. So where and when and how is this going to happen throughout the arts, the creative psyches of our artists, both in Vietnam and the Vietnamese American diaspora? Because without that, sort of that programming that the Japanese have with their culture, we are not going to arrive at Baotong, which is the conservancy of the beauty of who we are as the Vietnamese throughout the world.
Yeah, it's going to take a long time. I think because the dynamics are very different on this side of the sea than the other. In Vietnam, there is no government support for real artists, you know? I can tell you from just the literary point of view, I've been invited to Hong Kong, China, Singapore, Bali, you know, book festivals, right? Vietnam is claiming to be the next tiger. It does not have a book festival, you know? It does not have a way in which it rewards its own with acknowledgement of artistic accomplishments. You know, if you fly into South Korea, you know, they have a K-pop museum in the airport. You know, they saw their culture as a soft diplomacy entity that they can influence the world with. They actually have a collective effort to bring up their culture and create this pride, right? In Vietnam, it's sort of like stuck in slapstick and, you know, same kind of comedy that, you know, was influenced by Paris by Night, still play out in Vietnam. People still watch Paris by Night daily, you know, and laugh at the old jokes and stuff. So,
but I mean, it can't be strictly, I mean, I'm not saying you're saying that, but it can't be just a government directive that could pump up. I think
saying is that not only in Vietnam is it not recognized, it is hampered by censorship. Okay. So anyone who writes something that may mean something thinks twice about publishing it for fear of, you know, being punished.
Retribution, yeah.
Yes. And so people self-censor themselves all the time, right? And because of that atmosphere, there is no such thing as an intellectual gathering without government approval. There is no space in which you can rub minds and say, you know, I disagree with that point of view. Oh, this book is really critical of the way government did this and that, right? There's a subtext to this, and we should look at this other book by Orwell on, you know, 1984, or Animal Farm, and why it influenced the way, you know, literature came out. You know, that kind of intellectual conversation really doesn't exist because there is this fear that people think too deeply and create work that actually might say something meaningful and change the minds of Vietnam, right? And so there is this, not only is it not being lifted, it is actually being hampered by censorship, by the lack of freedom of expression in that country, you know? And so you see people who write pieces that may be interesting because it capture vignettes of Đồng Quê, you know, life in the rural or poverty of certain group of people, but it dares not to have a macro statement to say, this is the result of, you know, or, you know, and so because of that, there is no real breakout work that gives you this sense of, wow, this thing is like, changing the way we look at everything, right?
Okay, so let me build on top of this. I this is my theory that I'm positing. Like, the more I hear this about this sort of idea of government and censorship and everything, I almost feel though that it is part of the Confucian culture that manages top down. Yep. And even if we didn't have a communist government, even if we didn't have these oppressive sort of like feelings about the what we're creating in the arts, I think that our cultures are, especially the Southeast Asian cultures that are under Confucian, has this idea of control and this ultimate familial respect and these things of like, we don't want to offend our elders. And so our freedom is very different in the West because of our American heritage that we've inhaled, and we're now breathing the air that individualism and freedom here with our thoughts and the press. And I think it's a cultural thing that the party in Vietnam has dawned on as a result of the culture of being a top-down culture, a closed culture, a private culture that has taken on the form of government, censorship, all this stuff.
So they're,
how do you separate all this, you know?
Yeah, so they're not mutually exclusive. Confucianism and communism sort of play into each other to create this sort of like the an air of stiflement, if that's a word.
Yeah, because you think about our families in the U.S. that don't want to talk about politics, then they
control their mouth. That's what I say. I can only say, I disagree with you, Dad, but not Kong Kong Dong Yi.
Exactly. It's Confucian control. And yes. You know, we got to talk and, about and that level. That
actually, this is not just Vietnam, because if you look at China, you know, it's very much the bigger version of it, where, you know, anything that dares, you know, poked out, get hammered down, right? And so there are artists, of course, you know, Wei Ai and people like that who say something unique and important, but usually they're exiled, right?
Yep.
You know, there was a writer named Yung Tu Hu who wrote kind of daring pieces back in the 80s. And, you know, next thing you know, she's forced into exile, even though she was a communist member, you know,
right?
Because she criticized Cải Cách Ruộng Đất and, you know, Cultural Revolution and so on. And so, you know, so people saw her as an example of what could happen when you actually speak up. Right. My mom's older brother, who passed away, was a well-known musician for the Communist Party. And he wrote a book called Hồi Ký Của Một Thằng Hèn, Memoir of a Coward. And that had to be snuck out by PDF and published overseas because, you know, he couldn't publish it in Vietnam. And basically, he was under house arrest until he died.
Was that his memoir?
Yeah.
The Coward is Him?
The Coward is Him. Yeah.
Wow.
Because he couldn't speak up, you know, and he talked about under communism. He, you know, and I did a documentary called My Journey Home on PBS.
Yes,
and he's in it, and he is it's cut out. But basically, there was a moment where he opened his closet full of romantic music he wrote in the dark, with like his organ really silently played so that he can know the music. But then he wrote it and he put it away in the closet, because during that time you're not allowed, during the war, to publish romantic song, because that's, you know, take away the strength to fight the enemy. So he had hundreds of songs that he wrote that never saw the daylight. Literally, it's in the dark. And I asked him, like, why didn't you publish them? He said, well, because I would be punished. And I say, why don't you publish it now? It's like, right now it's too late, because everyone's listening to Britney Spears. But what I'm saying is that kind of mental self-censorship and censorship back then, because he had to, but even when he wanted to be published, the influence of the West and Korea and other countries have become so overwhelming that anything that's published locally is just mimic of the influence overseas, you know. There are Vietnamese now who sing in Vietnamese, but sound accent-wise like Koreans, because they are so influenced that they have no idea that their accent have shifted to sound more Korean, you know. and young people start speaking with that Korean kind of mumble, you know, because they are so influenced by Korean culture, you know, so much of it. But I can tell you that was true when I was a kid, because everyone's, you know, sang French songs and, you know, and then, you know, Vietnamese guy named Elvis Phuong, you know, because he was influenced by, you know, Elvis Presley and so on. So you start seeing Vietnamese adding Korean words into their songs now. You know what I mean? We're like, we're so like, as a country, that there is such an overseas influence, you know, and so there is, I hate to say it, but there is a kind of sense of inferiority complex, because while world productive culture overwhelmed Vietnam like a tsunami, locally people realize their work is not up to par, while everyone is admiring foreign works, you know. So there is this sense of like, we're nothing, you know. And now there are efforts by individuals. That's why I love certain individuals say, screw that, I'm just going to create what I need to create. But for the most part, it's just people overwhelmed by world culture.
So I think we've stumbled upon something that I have been exploring for ever since I've started the podcast, is this. Because of this Confucian sort of, everybody has to play in the community, everybody has to be on the same level, everybody has to be the same, that you can't really stick out, or otherwise you get hammered down. You can't stick out for your individualism. You're a village,
right?
And because of that, we self-censor, and because we self-censor, we can't create something powerful. We can't create powerful narratives that are based on individual free thinking ideas. And the United States does that the best, is the ability to have discourse, the ability to go as far as you possibly can with your own private imprimatur of who you are in the world, allows you to create the most bizarre, the most weird, out there, strange creations. And those creations, that authenticity allows the world to connect with the individual artists.
Right.
That is what we lack in Asia.
Yeah. I think that's, but to strike out, you have to overcome all those barriers that we talk about, that Confucian mindset that say, fuck it, I'm just going to follow my own vision. You know, that sense like, okay, I might risk being arrested, but I need to say something important to me. And usually you recognize that kind of authenticity, you know, but rarely does it happen. Rarely does it happen. And when
it
does happen,
it's hard.
It's very hard. And so, but it's when it does happen, it does move the needle. You know, when it's something like original come out, it changes the way we look at something. Right. And so I would say that the country is very ripe for change. Because there's so many young people hungry for new way of doing things, you know?
Yeah, and that, I think that's why Vietnamese rap music is so important right now. Vietnamese rap is vital to the change in direction. But I want to also bring it back, though, because I find I struggle with the idea of like, how much of this Western sort of influence is too much, to where we start to lose the respect, we lose the communal, we lose the village, you know, feel of our communities. Because I really do enjoy the idea of us being a village and respecting my elders. I love all that stuff that is very Vietnamese. But at what point because I straddle within my family and my society the idea of respect versus like, I'm going to say, fuck it, and I'm going to speak my voice. So there's this both, this dynamics that's weird at play for us.
Yeah, I think I think that pushing the envelope and going too far is also part of the way in which these things work, is that people are going to create a bigger space, and then some people will find a way to navigate between the two extremes in some way, you know? But I think whatever works will rise to the fore, because then you have people who recognize something that is collective and yet individual at the same time. You know, this playwright named, I think, Quy Nguyen, he wrote Việc Gone, mm-hmm. and And the other one plays, and he, I think he's really original in some way because
he's broken into Disney and stuff like that too.
Yeah, but like, have you seen Viet Gone?
I sure have.
Yeah, what really I find fascinating was how he inverted language. You know, where the American speaking terrible broken English, and the Vietnamese refugee was speaking like jargon English, and it slowly turned out that this is in his head, that in fact all this was happening in Vietnamese, right? But the only way for American audience to appreciate it is to see how articulate and witty and powerful these characters are in their own language, right? But the only way to do it is actually in English, because that's how we write novels, right? We write about Vietnamese who may be speaking Vietnamese to each other, but then we have to invert it in order for American readers or non-Vietnamese readers to understand what the hell is going on, right? And so what I really appreciate is like you didn't get that until like halfway through. Like, that's really good, because like you got me, you know what I mean? And we want things like that. We want things that is somehow still has its history rooted in that memory,
but also it's innovative.
Innovative and new, that it entertains. I mean, when you're talking about food, you know, like there's a lot of young people who take grandma's recipes and adding stuff to it. And some of it don't work, but some of it, when it works, it's like, wow, this is going to be the new classic. You know what I mean? You know, yeah. There is this one drink in Hanoi that I thought it was so interesting, is that Kakung Martini. You know what Kakung is?
Yeah, I sure do. I love Kakung. It's the insect drop or essence. Like, I love that. Kakung is like banana flavor. Like,
yeah, it's very flavor. It can be, it's almost too synthetic in the smell in a way, but it has a very powerful fragrance, like cologne almost.
Yep.
And they just dip a lot of that in your vodka martini, right? And I'm like, oh, I never thought of doing that.
Wow.
You know what I mean? You know, and so there are ways to invent and reinvent, you know, so the question is it good? And is it good? Are you going to get away with that? You know, and so I think that there are still a lot of things to discover and a lot of things to say, you know, in a way that could change the way we look at ourselves and our place in the world.
What a beautiful transition to talk about Kakung, because it is, for me, I don't enjoy Chaka Lavong or Chaka Thanglong, you know, the deal turmeric fish without it, you know, because I was introduced to that thing when I was a child, and I can't eat it without it. But that's one of the beautiful things about the Vietnamese culture, is this. I don't know if anybody else in the world uses Kakung. You know, who figured that out? And the ingenuity of the Vietnamese. I mean, there's probably hundreds of dishes that mimic that kind of stuff that you're like, wow, this is like, for example, who thought of thick can?
Right.
Kakung?
So, you know, this is where it's interesting, because literature and some kind of art can be very provocative and get clamped down. But in certain other area, like architecture or food or coffee, my God, Vietnam is excelling, you know, because you have incredible architecture now coming out the woodwork. You have food that is going to be experimental more and more if people started to think deeply. And if you go to Vietnam now, you go to like one of my favorite coffee shop, every other day there is a workshop for young people to talk about how to roast a certain type of coffee. You know, they love talking about coffee the way my siblings talk about wines from Napa. You know what I mean? So there is a passion there. And in those areas, there is no self-censorship because it's not provocative in the political sense. And so I think there's a lot of hope in those areas. And Vietnamese sensibility when it comes to taste, literally taste, it's really excelling, you know? And so, you know, you can see that. And you feel like, wow, you know, the food scene in Vietnam is incredible right now.
Yep. You know? Let's clarify this then. It's anything that challenges authority is where you really have to do the self-censoring.
Yeah, right. It's and a, so, it's, you know, like architecture isn't, you know, challenging or food isn't.
Food, music.
Yeah. And so therefore there are areas where it excels.
And even sex. Yeah. Sex does not challenge authority. And I think sex in Vietnam is, I feel like it's almost much more free than...
Well, I don't want to get another hour in. But it's not only more free. I think it's so much more liberal than America. Because I think the fluidity of sexuality in Vietnam is beyond understanding. And when I tell this to old Vietnamese here, they're like, how? Vietnam was so conservative when I left. I say, yeah, that's 50 years ago, bro. You know, you go online and people hooking up and you're like, okay, I can't tell if straight, gay, or somewhere in between, and sometimes no one cares, you know? And so, and then...
Let's go for another hour, Andrew, about this.
And then so what happened?
I seem to have hit a good nerve here with you.
Well, no, because it's so obvious to me that the sexual revolution is the real revolution of Vietnam. But the sexual freedom of Vietnam is stunning.
Ladies and gentlemen, there will be a part two with Andrew and I talking about the sexual revolution of Vietnam.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. You know, no doubt about it. There are TV shows in Vietnam where someone who of transgender is a TV star hosting TV shows. You know, there are TV shows where straight or gay or in between, where you have people who sit as, you know, like judges, you know, like your Paula Abdul with a pink or a blue card, and some handsome dude come out and say, I'm an architect. You know, I have a black belt in Taekwondo. You know, I have a 3-year-old kid. And then people ask questions because he's so handsome. It's like, and then they say, okay, straight or gay, right? And then so then people get into this whole litany of like, I can tell from his voice that he's a top, you know, you know, so the sexuality of Vietnam is stunning, you know, because there is one area that the government doesn't give a damn about is sex.
Right? Sounds fun, too.
And then the same thing as on YouTube programmings on individuals, they would do, you know, like really cheap but funny episodes of young people falling in love in a soccer field and like two boys sharing the same room, that sort of thing. And you're like, oh my God, this is amazing because we don't have that in the U.S.
In the States, yeah. And I think even the laws in Vietnam about sexual orientation protection, I think, was way more advanced than it was in the United States.
They don't legally recognize Vietnamese gay marriages, but they are for gay weddings and so on, lesbian weddings and so on. So you see, you know, male couples getting married on the street and stuff, you know. And so I think the freedom... It's incredible, you know. Most people don't know it, but like there are at least 11 gay saunas in Saigon, you know. So you're talking about sexual freedom, right? I mean,
it's wide open. Incredible.
Yeah. And most Vietnamese in Orange County is like, oh, we're a conservative people. It's like, not lately, no.
Not in Vietnam. Not in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And sexuality in Vietnam has never been a big issue. I mean, it's just kept under wraps because of the culture is very modest.
Yeah.
But what
happened? Yeah, it's funny because it's similar to Japan in some sense.
Yeah.
That the language itself doesn't really talk about it. You know, the written language doesn't really have a framework for this kind of narrative, but the actions are completely free, you know. And so I think that's why language and actions are not catching up. In fact, they're out of pace, you know, because the written language is so powerful still in a lot of this country, especially in Vietnam and China, so that you cannot have things that describe the actual things that are happening on the social, on the ground level, you know, day-to-day level. Because if you talk about it, then you have to do something about it. And the government, just like the Vietnamese people of our older generation, making assumption of our conservatism and so on. But in reality, the society itself have moved like light years ahead, you know?
Well, let's bring up this point of language. The English language has an advantage of all of these different languages being put in daily. I mean, even on the Ebonics level, right? Yeah. You take all of these different new vocabulary that's popping up all over the world, and it's just brought back into American English or British English or Australian English. And so you have this rich tapestry of like vocabulary. But Vietnam has a much more limited vocabulary, but it's also more limited by the strata of when you got to the United States. So, for example, in 1975, your parents got to the United States, or 1990. Their use of whatever Vietnamese language is still encoded in a very specific time capsule. And then what's happening in Vietnam, for example, BDSM, or all of these other terminologies that is happening on the ground level in the sexual fantasy world is starting to happen. But all of our parents that are existing in the United States are not privy to the creation of computer technology language, sex language, all of these other languages that are developing in Vietnam. So there's this sort of like break that we are disconnected from.
Right. There's a lot of things that are out of sync. Right?
Out of sync.
The language of Việt Kiều is completely different than the language of Vietnamese, for instance, you know. And I have a friend in Vietnam who's a translator, and he say, oh, you know, and there's this book that is written already in Vietnamese before 75. And he say, oh, I'm translating this book. And I'm saying, what do you mean it's in Vietnamese? How are you translating? He say, this is before 75 language, you know, people are not going to get it. So he has to rewrite
it. Wow.
You know, books that are translated in Vietnamese already, but are translated before 75, right? And then even some years ago, a friend of mine at Google asked me if I want to help him out translating products into Vietnamese for Vietnam. Right. And I say, you're asking the wrong guy. My Vietnamese is not bad, but my Vietnamese is Việt Kiều Vietnamese. And most of the things I say when I go into Vietnam, they say, oh, my God, I haven't heard this phrase for 30 years.
I get that all the time. I get that all the time.
Yeah. And sometimes when I speak Vietnamese, people in Vietnam say, my God, you know, my God, my grandmother used to speak this sentence, and I'm thinking like, what, my James Dean from the 50s? What, you know what I mean? Like it's how it feels, you know. So yes. There's a lot of things out of sync, but not only that, but I think for Vietnamese, the written language is so important because that's how the government control things, you know, so that freedom is allowed as long as it's not written. Example, I was sitting in Hanoi with a group of people who are intellectual journalists from Vietnam. And we're talking about freedom of expression and so on. And he, one of them say, I don't know why you're harping on this, because you can look out and everyone's free. We can fly to Bangkok and shop and da-da-da. We can do everything, right? Just like someone from a free country. So I don't see why it's a big deal about this expression. And I say, this is why it's a problem, because you see that sign over there, when Uncle Ho says something, there's a sign of backhoe noise or something. I don't even remember what he said. But I say, the true freedom is to buy a billboard on the opposite side and say, tôi không đồng ý. I disagree. And he looked at me and his face paled. Why? Because it never occurred to him.
To him that you can do that.
That you can do that. That there is this fourth space, you know, dimension, that for so long didn't exist for generation, to the point where not only does he not recognize that existing billboard because they learned to ignore it, but therefore he cannot imagine
there's a reality that you can do it.
That you can do it, because already it's a locked in mindset. You know what I mean? So language itself becomes so static.
Yeah.
You know, and you look at the, say, the communist government who have these constitutions, like Vietnamese people agree that the Communist Party is the only party that run the country. That I don't even know what it really says, but this is a language that's written way back when, right? And so it doesn't really apply to capitalism or you know, multi-party system, or that people have the right to change their mind or anything. But that's the language that is controlling the reason why the government is in the center of the power. So then, therefore, if you shift the language, what happened then? You know, people get to say what they want to say, then what happens? You know?
And a lot of things that I've come encountered with this sort of debate in Vietnam is, why would you even want to challenge that billboard?
Yeah. You know,
that's a big thing. It's like,
because that's how you bring in the fourth dimension.
Yeah.
That's how you begin to free the mind to actually say something important.
It's like, why do you even have the need to challenge this? I'm like,
yeah, because life is good right now, right?
Yeah, it's perfect.
Why we have all the sex we want, more than we want. You know, I don't disagree with that, but
Andrew, I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation today. You're a lot of fun to chit chat. When does your new book come out?
March 28, 2025, a month before the 50 years anniversary of the end of.
You know what? Let's get back on it. Let's schedule a time, maybe a week before the book launches, so we can remind everybody, and then we can talk about. I think it'll be fun to talk about the 50th anniversary.
With fun you. In a way and sad in another way. But you know, it's kind of ironic and kind of apropos too, is that I left Vietnam on the 28th of April 1975. You know, so this book is going to come out one month. Exactly ahead of that date. So it's quite a roundabout way of saying, hey, a full circle.
Yeah, I look forward to that. Let's have that conversation. Let's have it maybe a week before March 28th. We'll schedule after this, and then
Just send me your address, and I have a book sent to you at some point.
Perfect. I would love that. And I have a lot of feelings about this next year. Some good, some really screwy ideas, and some, you know, it's a mixed bag for me, I'm sure. For a lot of us, it's a mixed bag. So thank you so much for coming on today, and it was such a pleasure talking with you, Andrew.
Sure. All right, catch you later.
Okay,
thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.